Hello, everyone, and welcome to 99% Effective. I'm glad to be back. Myself and Jen were not able to join George in December.
December.
So, and now it's just me and Jen. We will now be the new co-hosts moving forward. And here we are in January in a very mild winter. I am going to knock on wood. So I'm ready. How many days? It's less than 60 days to spring.
We need some snow. I'm sorry. This is where we're going to go at it. I am an avid skier. We need a blizzard.
Oh, yeah. I am not a skier at all. I like the fireplace and all that fun stuff. But yeah, I'm ready for spring now. But how are your holidays?
Fattening.
Yeah.
Fattening, family, fun. So I can't complain. How about you?
I like that. I like that. It was excellent. We had a great time. I felt like it was the first holidays that it seemed to be completely back to normal.
Yes, you're right.
So it was a good time.
And Happy New Year to you. The last time we talked was last year.
Yes, it was. Yes, I remember my father would leave on New Year's Eve. He owned a restaurant and he would say, "See you next year." And I would go into a panic because I was too young to realize what he was doing. But so we're back. It's 2023. We have some amazing podcasts coming up. And today is no exception. We have two amazing individuals from the Department of Developmental Services, DDS, and we're going to get right into it.
Absolutely. I got to tell you, Tisha, I'm really excited about this podcast that we're doing today.
I think it's going to be extremely helpful for schools, families, and all of the above.
Absolutely. At this time, I'd like to introduce our two wonderful guests today. Barbara Poplowski, DDS Transition Advisor, and then Brian Smith, Assistant Regional Director of Individual and Family Supports for DDS. Now, I'm going to turn it over to both of you to give us an idea of what you do for the state. And Barbara, I'm going to start with you.
Hi, I'm Barbara Poplowski. I'm the DDS Transition Advisor out of the Wallingford office, which is the South Region, and I work with families and individuals and state agencies and schools to plan for individuals from transitioning from school to adult life.
And I'm Brian Smith, and I'm the Assistant Regional Director, as mentioned, and I oversee the Individual and Family Support Division in the Southern Region of Connecticut. And I oversee the entire division for the IFS family, so that includes case management services, four respite centers, in-home workers, clinical staff, including our transition advisors as well, and case management services, and a host of other unrelated activities.
Wonderful. Well, again, thank you both for being here. It's nice to have you. And honestly, I would like to just jump right into this. Barb, ladies first. So one of the questions that I get most frequently from families, parents is eligibility. So let's talk about this. How does an individual qualify for DDS supports?
Well, typically what I like to tell families is that any time after the age of 8 and an individual has an IQ of 69 or below, they should apply for services for DDS, because even though we're more of an adult agency, we do have modest supports for families when the children are younger. And the most important reason, in my belief, is that we plan for that individual. We know about them early and we can start the planning, because transition really should be from elementary school on.
Mm-hmm.
That's what typically I recommend. Sometimes individuals come through us through birth to three, but they do have mm-hmm. to be redetermined after the age of 8 once they have a formal IQ.
So that's interesting. You're saying the age of 8. I know a lot of people, whenever they think of DDS in the program, think of 16 or 18. How is 8 the magic number?
Well, it's just that's when families can have that diagnosis of an ID.
Okay.
So anytime after the age of 8 is what I say, but the earlier the better, just for planning, and that there's some modest supports that families can take advantage of if they need it.
Okay.
And just to add to Barbara's information, we do have youth who come through right after birth of three services. Those services are available. It's really when the school systems are able to capture that initial IQ. So could it be anywhere from 5, 6, 7, 8, depending on the district, depending on the youth. it's that critical juncture that we encourage people, if they haven't come through a birth to three system, to entertain, if their loved one does have a diagnosis with an IQ 69 or lower, to apply for services. Again, voluntary agency, our services are accessible through our helpline, which we'll get a little more into through the questions today, but it gets that individual into our system where we can do some planning behind the scenes, whether or not they access any of the services or not. The later in life you come through eligibility, you're almost at a deficit because you didn't access any of those potential resources, and we haven't been planning for those years. So the earlier the better is always the message we like to promote. But it's a comfort zone. Families have to make that decision on their own of when they're ready to make that decision to make that application.
And who typically initiates the IQ test? Is that the school or
the school?
The school. Okay, that's very helpful.
The PPT process.
Do families, when their child's eight and they start this process and they become eligible for DDS supports, is there a like every year do they have to get another evaluation, or what does that look like?
Well, typically they have the evaluation and then the school system does a triennial every 3 years, which is best practice. Sometimes they just review the file, but you know, we'll see individuals have an IQ at the age of 9 and then, you know, they're 18 and nothing has been done in between. So we really, best practice is for a school system to do the triennial and do the cognitive testing and the adaptive testing and any other testing that needs to be done.
So if a parent would like their child to get tested, do they reach out to the state? Do they go through the school system?
They would go through the school system.
Okay, so that's really their first step, is having that conversation.
Right.
Okay, excellent. And so as far as resources in the helpline, Brian, you briefly touched on this. What services does DDS provide to individuals who aren't school?
So if the individual is deemed eligible for DDS services, they have access to a variety of different resources. And depending on need, accessibility of that resource will depend on what we're able to offer. So one big thing is our respite centers. We do find that some families choose not to access them at a younger age when their loved one is maybe elementary school or even middle school for that matter. However, they are available in the South region of DDS, does have 4. We have one located in Waterford, one on the Hamden-New Haven line, Middletown, and Meriden as well.
Can you tell me what is a respite center?
Led you right into that question.
Yes.
So a respite center is, all of ours are homes with the exception of Meriden. Meriden is on the campus over there, so it's more of a unit style for that one in particular. But these centers are run by the state. They're run by DDS. We do staff it 24/7 during the operation. And they do a lot of community inclusion activities, in-house activities as well. We've put a lot of technology into our respite centers as well, so it gives it a lot of exposure for our guests and families alike to see how technology could benefit their loved one, even in the family home. So I mentioned it is staffed by DDS personnel. The only cost for respite centers for a family, we ask for about $75, $80, and that's personal spending money. It's all accounted for, and receipts and changes all returned back to the family, but that's for if they go out to lunch or out to dinner, or the movies, a fair, or whatever the activity is for that particular weekend, or activities, shall I say. All the other expenses are absorbed within our agency budget, including staffing, transportation. The respite center in Meriden is 24/7, 365. So that's the anomaly out of all the respite centers in the state. It's the first one that we went with that model, so that way we can do a little bit of a longer term stay for caregivers whose health might be compromised. Recovering from surgery or maybe even a cardiac event or something along those lines, where our normal process of Thursday in the afternoon to Monday mornings doesn't work. So we really, this one goes that whole Monday to Monday kind of cycle. And if somebody needs to stay more than one full week, then we make that accommodation for that party. And that one also has nursing on staff for all 3 shifts. So it's got 2 different pieces than all the other centers that we do have. Looking to expand that kind of platform in other regions mm-hmm. where we can actually physically do that. But it's great. We serve folks of all different ages.
That was my next question. Is there an age requirement for
there
that?
Is no age requirement. Again, it goes back to caregiver parent comfortness. We do see a lot more day visits with the younger kids, not ready for that overnight with us yet. Whereas some of the older participants and guests, they stay the entire time, Thursday at 4 till Monday at 10 a.m. So they're there the entire time.
What's the capacity that they can, these respite?
Most of our centers take up to 6 guests.
Okay.
One big thing with COVID, we did have to shut them down 3 times, not because of COVID spread, but we needed our staff in other settings.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to do redeployments. When we reopened them the third time, we did it at 50% capacity. So it was one guest per bedroom because all the bedrooms are shared.
Right.
And then we loosened that up. So we're at 100% capacity, and we respectfully inquire, are families comfortable with shared bedrooms if it's somebody coming from a different household they don't know? But we try to pair them off. So if two folks coming from Sarah were coming to us and they're in the same day program, we might, if it's reasonable, have them in the same bedroom since they're already in that day program cluster, shall we say. So we do a lot of creative groupings, but 6 is the max.
Okay. So I'm sure a lot of our listeners are now saying, wow, that sounds fantastic. So what would the next step be for them if they were interested in the respite?
I'm going to answer that question in tenfold.
Okay.
All the respite centers and all the other services that was mentioned through our, you can access through our helpline.
Okay.
If a family does not have a designated assigned case manager yet, they will access the services through the helpline staff.
So the helpline is a person's best friend if they don't have services
if
yet.
They don't have a direct assigned local case manager, correct.
Okay.
So the helpline or case management, that's the point of entry for these resources. They'll do all the requests, they'll do all the referrals, and then once they get through a certain layer of that referral process, then our staff in the respite center will take over from there. The supervisory staff, nursing staff will take over from there.
And where would we find the number for the helpline?
That is online. However, I do have it available.
You are good.
And we'll
I memorized
that.
Yeah. I was in the West region for 20 years, and I remember that phone number. So the South region phone number is 1-877-437-4567. And that's toll-free in Connecticut. So each of the regions do have a helpline that support over 2,000 individuals each.
Wow.
So it is a heavy load, taking all those calls in and doing all those requests and referrals, et cetera. So we do ask for a little patience on the response time, but they do get back in a swift manner as well. But some of the other resources that are available are family grants. We do have a family grant program that's available. Each region does have an allocation. Even though it's centralized, there is a committee that reviews everything that comes in to make sure we're doing things equitably and consistently throughout the state. The grants go to disability-related expenses, so that the bulk of the resources go to in-home or respite care, to be honest with you.
Okay.
So current, it's about $1.2 million per region.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like a lot of money, right? All of us in this room would love to have that maybe in our bank accounts right now. That goes fast. The needs are out there.
Right.
So we can see on average up to upwards of $600,000 to $800,000 in requests in a period of 3 months.
Wow.
So the needs are out there. So that goes very rapidly. It's quarterly deposits, so it controls the spending throughout the fiscal year. So it makes life a little easier.
And parents have to give, family members have to give receipts for
correct.
The grant, right?
Any grant that you do get, you do have to complete what we call expenditure reporting. Sorry about that. So that could be a log for respite staff, how much you pay them, the days they work, etc. Or receipts of purchases of particular disability-related goods that you were approved to do so. The critical piece about the grants is you have to request the money before you spend the money. So you can't, if you put in a request and for something that you bought 2 weeks ago or a month ago and it was disability-related, we can't do anything about it. You got to get the request in and let us process it, review it, approve whatever value, and then go get that goods or services. So that's one of the critical pieces.
Is there a cap per family for
grants, family grants?
Good question. It's not per family. Mm-hmm. It's per individual. Because
okay.
we do have families who have multiple
okay.
family
yeah.
members
mm-hmm.
in our system. So to be respectful of those families, it's based on individuals.
Mm-hmm.
So it's $4,999 a year.
Okay.
Okay. We can't give everybody who asks for grants that value. There's
right.
just not, when you do the math, there's just not enough money. Some people do hit that, and others don't even come close to that based on what they've asked for. So, but again, most of it does go to staffing. Would you agree, Barbara?
Yes, and also summer camps.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
We do get some technology requests.
I was going to ask you about technology.
Some medical requests,
mm-hmm.
But we always look to see, is there another responsible party, like insurance companies or
right.
school districts?
Mm-hmm.
So depending on who, what's being requested, there might be some additional information required.
And that's good to know, because the families may be requesting that, but they may not even know that there's other resources out there to help them get that.
Correct.
So they could use this funding for staffing. More
correct.
Than something
correct.
Like that.
So there mm-hmm. might be another way to cover this need,
mm-hmm.
and that frees up the money that you get for a grant, or you're focused on a grant for a different need.
Right.
So we work through all those logistics. We're doing some great work in collaboration with the State Department of Education, and we'll also have some additional resources through ARPA funding, the American Rescue Plan Act.
Mm-hmm.
So it's freeing up some more dollars to get into some more family homes as well, depending
mm-hmm.
on certain criteria. So,
that's fantastic.
Those are kind of short term, so we don't like to talk about that more in our annualized conversation, but
right
now we're running with, we have more dollars than we normally do, so our grant team is looking to see if a grant comes in, hey, we might be able to fund it this way versus this way. So they're sorting that out on their end.
Mm-hmm.
So the grants are a phenomenal resource. So it goes fiscal year. So it's not a January to December year. It's a July 1st to June 30th. We work off the state's fiscal year. So
are there any other services that are offered to individuals who are still in school other than the respite and the grants?
Yep. So we have the barbers of the world. So we do have our transition advisor staff. We have three of those positions in each of the regions. We do have one vacancy, and we're looking to, unfortunately, fill Barbara's, because Barbara's retired. She's back helping us out while we wait to be able to fill that. So we have those three per region who work with school-age youth in those transition years. We do have opportunities to access psychologists, nurses,
mm-hmm.
Physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech and language pathology. Those particular behaviorists as well, my apologies. That group is on consultative basis. So they're not doing direct therapy or direct nursing or direct psychiatric supports, but they are on a consult basis to the individual based on need. So the team really comes into play there, what the situation is the team is facing, the individual is facing, and kind of sorting through, do we have an internal resource we can use on a consult basis to determine maybe next steps, recommendations to the family or to that individual. And then from there, move forward with maybe linkages to community resources through their medical insurance or other benefit programs. So the other group of resources are our family support worker team.
Mm-hmm.
We do have 21 of those staff in our region, that being the South. And those staff are brought in on referral. So a family may have a particular need. And one need is transportation.
Mm-hmm.
Small state, right? But transportation's a nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we all know that. And our agency recognizes that even when trying to get folks to and from day services or employment programs.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to...
job.
Exactly. So we're trying to figure out creative solutions around that. So it's a big focus up in Hartford and the regions alike. But we've had referrals for transportation to and from medical appointments. We've had referrals to and from our respite centers because families don't have a means of transportation to get their loved one to their center. But a lot of it also is done with addressing emergency situations, whether it be staffing an individual in the hospital because the hospital may not have a sitter resource available, or doing transport on an emergency situation, or doing community inclusion and recreational-based activities. So we do prioritize how we utilize them based on health and safety needs versus that recreational needs. So, and we do have a number of our staff in the South region are bilingual as well. So
mm-hmm.
that's a phenomenal resource for
mm-hmm.
those we support in this region. So those are a variety of different resources and supports that are available in a very short period of time to describe
right,
them.
Right.
But those are accessible to anybody who's on the helpline.
You did a fantastic job breaking them down. Thank you. And I just must give a shout out to Barb because we've worked together for some time now. She's just been invaluable to the families that she's helped through the school system and into this next phase for those who are graduating. So kudos to Barb.
Thank you, Jen.
But so all these wonderful services, what's the next step? How does a family get introduced to supports?
So the critical piece, we go back to the original question, is eligibility.
Mm-hmm.
Those resources are not available if you haven't gone through that eligibility process. So that's the critical piece, making that decision and going through eligibility. Because once you're deemed eligible, that big step is addressed.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're eligible, now you can access. And as I mentioned, the access point is the helpline, and the access point is through the case manager, depending on if you have a case manager presently assigned to you. But then how do you find out about these resources is reaching out to the helpline.
Okay.
Participating in events like this,
mm-hmm.
Resource fairs that some community providers and school districts do offer. So there's a host of different ways to get the information, but accessing it would predominantly be through that helpline. And if you're not supported through the helpline, you have a case manager and you just remember that 877 number I gave you, they call that number.
Right.
They will help guide you through that process in the end, or get your case manager to give you a call. They'll be able to look
so that's a good segue into case management. So a couple things. At what age do you get assigned a case manager? And does somebody never have a case manager, or does everyone always have a case manager?
Well, that's a good question. There is no golden answer to that.
There's a lot of moving parts with this.
There are folks who are supported by the helpline indefinitely.
Okay.
It is a personal choice. You know, they don't access services through us. They don't want any resources from our agency.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have folks who are on the helpline for extended periods of time. And that's fine. We respect those decisions. They live relatively independently in their community, or their families don't see the need to access DDS resources because they have resources themselves, or feel that they are able to support their loved one independent of state or federal assistance. So we have that group. We also have the group who are ineligible or choose not to enroll in Medicaid. And Medicaid is the critical component to getting case management services. A number of years ago, with a mass exit and some layoffs under two governors ago, I can't remember now, we had to shift all our case management resources to
I remember
cases.
That. Yeah.
You remember that?
2009 around?
To cases that were waiver generating caseloads. So folks who are in residential settings, folks who are getting their employment services, they have annualized money from the agency. We are responsible for making sure we have case managers assigned to meet certain regulations. Plus, it also allows us to do some reimbursement billing through the Medicaid actual insurance to no impact on the individual. So when you ask the question, is there what age? There is no magic age. The critical piece is when they can get on Husky C.
Gotcha. Okay.
And in Connecticut, the Medicaid program is called Husky.
Right.
But if you use Title 19 or Medicaid in any other state, everybody will know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
If you talk about Husky C in Pennsylvania, they're not going to know that
that's
the Medicaid program.
What is Husky C exactly? Because I know there's A, B, C, D.
Correct. There is A, B, C, D. So C is specifically for individuals with disabilities.
Okay.
D is for low-income adults.
Mm-hmm.
So we do often see folks who do apply get put on D.
Right.
And we work to try to get them off of D onto C.
Okay. So that's just
it's a
clerical communication issue.
It might be just the way the application was read, interpreted, entered, et cetera. So... in some cases, we see that more frequently. Wouldn't you agree, Barbara? Somebody applies for Medicaid before they've had resolution on their Social Security application for the Supplemental Security Income, SSI benefit. So if you get that SSI squared away first and then apply for Medicaid, it usually goes a little easier and it gets put onto the right Husky track.
Okay.
Because they use a disability determination by SSI to deem the individual disabled for the Husky C.
So is it safe to say case management equals Husky C?
Correct.
The helpline will help them, you know, work them through the Husky C application,
okay,
or our family support workers for families that really have a need. Will also, there'll be a request for them to help the families. And we always tell the families, write Husky C all over it.
Right.
So, because it does happen a lot that they get Husky, they're put on Husky D rather than the C. And
gotcha. So this kind of could be a loaded question. How is the communication between DDS and Husky?
And DSS?
And DSS.
So let me roll back before I answer that loaded question with my air quotations. So to speak to what Barbara was saying in your response, Keisha, that the Husky C equals case management, in theory it does.
Mm-hmm.
However, we do have to look at when that Husky C is awarded. Somebody might get that Husky C at 19 or
mm-hmm.
20.
Mm-hmm.
They might not get a case manager till closer to 21.
Okay.
Ish. So we're mm-hmm. trying to really target that 6 to 12 months before they exit school
mm-hmm.
at 22 to get the case manager
gotcha.
In play. However, sitting in the role that I do, there's times that I have cases assigned even if they don't have Husky C
mm-hmm.
because of emergent needs or home circumstances or individual circumstances. So I have that magic wand to say
right.
this case needs to be signed because of X, Y, and Z criteria. But for the most part, it is that Husky C that
mm-hmm.
allows us the opportunity to look to assign that case to a case manager. Our ultimate goal, again, is 6 months to 12 months before they exit school. And a lot of that can vary based on the office the case is going to and caseload space in that
right.
office.
Yeah.
So in the South region, it has three offices. We have our regional headquarters is in Wallingford. We have an office in New Haven and then Norwich. So
now, does each DDS region have three?
No.
Okay.
No.
So, Brian, what happens if somebody hits their 22nd birthday and they still don't have their Husky C?
We continue to work with the individual and the family to rectify that so that way we can get them in alignment for services. But often where we have some situations where it might be a personal choice, they don't want to go on it. We document our conversations regularly. Because ultimately the funding that was being planned for that youth to enter into an employment or day services after school, we have to account for those resources by a certain time.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're not going to get onto the Husky C or Medicaid to allow us to assign those dollars to them for those services, we often ask for that in writing if possible.
Right.
So that way we have that commitment, that decision. And then we reallocate those dollars to another person who is in need.
Do you see, because individuals, the federal law allows them to stay on their parents' insurance until they're 26.
They can. Please
mm-hmm.
do. But also enroll in Medicaid.
Mm-hmm. So you can do both.
You
and
can
have
do both.
Primary and secondary insurance.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
That's
yes.
where I was
so
going.
There's
yeah.
a very common question, and parents are often hesitant to enroll in Medicaid, fearing that's going to have an impact on private insurance.
Mm-hmm.
There is no impact. Keep the private insurance for as long as you possibly can. We recommend that.
Is private considered secondary?
It's primary.
It is primary.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then your Husky C will be secondary.
Medicaid is always the payee of last resort.
Okay.
No matter where you live in the United States,
mm-hmm.
it will be the last payee. So always work through, keep the private for as long as you can. We've had folks on Medicaid, Medicare, and private. So
mm-hmm.
keep them all.
Okay, that's great
for
to
as
know.
Long as he or she is eligible. But start that enrollment in this SSI, Social Security Program, the Supplemental Security Income at 18, and enroll in Medicaid Husky
mm-hmm.
C that once you get that award. Because now you'll have two forms of insurance, which will benefit the individual,
absolutely.
First and foremost, and then benefit them indirectly by accessing additional services
mm-hmm.
through us, including case management.
So, Brian, I know that we're all very clear right now that them getting enrolled is critical. Especially prior to that 22nd birthday. But in talking to a number of families, sometimes life just gets in the way.
Mm-hmm.
They're missing these deadlines. Their loved ones hits 22 and they're like, oh my goodness, here I am. I'm behind the eight ball. I should have started this a year ago. What would your message be to those families that might not be as up to date as they should with getting these the Medicaid Husky Seed?
Just like our enrollment, for eligibility, sooner the better. You can start that process at 22. We cannot allocate resources until that's in place. Mm-hmm. So the real hard message is problem solving. How are you going to support your loved one from the 22nd birthday forward until you can access the resources through our agency once that Medicaid is in place? And some folks have a nice wide range of natural supports, and they are able to do that. But not everybody has that, and we recognize that. So there might be some collaboration with other families to say, oh, I can do Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Can you do Tuesday, Thursday? And kind of build your own little support network. Could access our grant for respite services. We cannot use grants for day or employment services at present. So it would be for respite. But you'll find that covering that 30 hours, we'll say, in the course of Monday through Friday, can be expensive. Yeah. So that's not going to get you far as respite is concerned with a family grant. So the real critical piece is applying early.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, once we get into our conversations with the Barbers of the world of transition, they're going to be out there, you know, talking with the school district, talking with families, and trying to get this resolved so we don't get to that 22nd birthday. I'd rather the issue be on the state's end resolving an application than an application not getting in before then, so that way we can get those resources to the individual. So when in doubt, just to get it done, apply. They're not the only ones. We deal with it every single year. They're not the anomaly, but we want to make sure.
And I think the message to parents is don't beat yourself up over it either. Like,
no.
It is what it is at this point. So you just now do what you have to do. Yep.
The critical piece is you have a team on our side that can help you through that process, mm-hmm. whether it be a transition advisor or a helpline case manager, or if you needed that immediate direction support, one of our family support workers. We have resources to help navigate that process, mm-hmm. and to get it off your kitchen table and in the mail. So we have that process. We have a team that can help you with through this. You're not going out alone, and I actually encourage families to use us so that way that the applications are done in a manner that there won't be any issues along that review or entry process. So make sure that all the supplementary documentation that has to go with it is included, so there's not a rejection because of missing bank account or whatever, beneficiary stuff.
So talking, you brought up documentation. So what are some of the things that are involved? You know, we hear so many acronyms. What's a LON? IP, you know, life course. Can you just summarize, you know, the best you can on what some of those are and that are going to be needed?
Well, the wonderful thing is that almost every state agency has a link on their website for acronyms.
Yes.
So thank you for that, right? Because we do live in the world of acronyms.
Absolutely.
In our agency, and every state agency does for that matter, and districts alike.
Right.
Great with PPTs and mm-hmm. IEPs. And, the IP that you referenced is the individual plan.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our service plan, similar to a student's IEP.
Okay.
It has a different focus, a different appearance, different look altogether. And actually our newer individual plan document has embedded certain tools that come from the life course,
mm-hmm.
Which is a person-centered planning model. We've adopted that as an agency here in Connecticut. Some families might be familiar with MAPS and PATHS,
mm-hmm.
coming from the school systems, or RENEW. So there's a host of different person-centered planning modules out there. We've chosen Life Course, brought it in 10 years ago.
Wow.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's had a 10-year anniversary. So, and with that, they've embedded several of those tools right into our individual plan document, and that is an effort to really bring the individual back into that plan, that
mm-hmm.
service plan, and have them be the ultimate focus and hear their voice, whether it be verbally through art or through their loved ones or caregivers speaking on their behalf if they're unable to do so themselves. So there is a real big focus in on that. You mentioned the LON, the L-O-N. That's the level of need. So that assessment tool is done by our case management staff with the team. And that gives us an idea of the level of need for employment day services as for residential services. So that's one of the critical tools that we utilize to identify fiscal resources for that employment day service for a student coming out of school, or if someone is going into a residential location, it gives us a funding parameters for that individual based on their needs. And then that kind of brings you almost into an alignment of different services based on somebody's level of needs. So those are the big names in our world, but there's a host of other acronyms that we throw around. So when in doubt, stop us from talking and ask us, what did you mean by that? Because we get caught up in that. But again, on our website, there is a link for acronyms. So you can, it's multiple pages.
I can't tell you how many times I have to look up an acronym. I'm like, oh, no, I can't find it.
And I sit in meetings with other state agents, like, what is that?
Yeah. And it's just no one's doing it. It's just the way we talk. And it's a muscle memory thing.
Yep.
So for families and parents, just stop and say, please, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep. And I've actually done that in other presentations where somebody else in my agency or another agency was talking and throwing out an acronym. And I'm like, I'm not the only one. Or I do know that, but I know that most of this group probably doesn't, just because of the audience. And I'll be the one to raise my hand on the virtual screen and go, can you just explain what that that acronym meant? And then 5 minute conversation goes.
So I have a question for you, and this is a burning question.
Oh, well, boy. If
you can answer this, I'm going to be impressed. Not just myself, but some families too. So the LON summary gives you a number between 1 and 8.
Correct.
How is that number generated?
So when the level of need was developed, it's a data system that our staff will enter in all your responses, clicking the boxes. They hit complete, and it goes into a scoring system. So there's an algorithm behind the scenes that once they hit complete on that level of need assessment, it generates that summary.
Excellent.
So there is a behind-the-scenes algorithm, and we all know there's nothing that's perfect in this world. There's flaws in the algorithm. We know it. It goes great for the bulk of our population we support, but there are certain categories or segments of our population, shall we say, that it somewhat can miss the mark depending on how it's scored. So there are appeal processes around that.
Mm-hmm.
Some family feels as though that it's not accurately representing their loved one. So we can work you through that if there is a need for that. But you are correct. It goes from 1 to 8, 8 being the most highest need. And in my 20 years, but we haven't had the LON for 20 plus years. But since the LON has been around, I think I've maybe seen 10 eights.
Wow.
Not a common score.
Mm-hmm.
It just gives us some funding parameters, and those composite scores we look at, but we also look at the behavioral score on that summary. And so our funding, if the behavior score ends up being higher on the front page than the composite score, we actually plan at the higher value of that behavior score.
So you just brought up a very interesting topic. You said funding parameter.
Correct.
How is the long summary? How is that factored into that?
So for every one of those numbers, 1 through 8, there's a correlating number of fiscal resources for day and for residential. So if you're a LON score of 2, the correlated number is this value. If you're a 5, it's going to be higher. It's going to be this value. And for residential, there's a column of 1 through 8 with those correlated numbers based on need. So it gives us some funding parameters. Now, we do realize that some individuals may have needs that exceed what that funding is.
Mm-hmm.
So there's mechanisms internally to request enhanced resources, and that often would trigger annual or triennial type of review called a utilization review, which we would walk that team through if it does require that and what the expectations are. So we do realize that some folks, that level of need funding cap is insufficient, so the team just got to work through that. And that'll bring me into our graduates. Every year, right, Barbara, we get asked, are there grads who need enhanced funding?
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to need one-to-one, or in some cases, more than that? Through our helpline or through our case management staff and our transition advisors alike, that triad of our internal supports, are working with the districts and the family on identifying those youth so we can ask for those resources to be built into our projections for that student.
So that's another great segue. You're good at segues, Brian.
It's like he knows what you're going to say.
Yeah. So talking about transition and day employment services.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the basic questions I want to ask is, a lot of people hear that an individual gets support through the school system up until their 22nd birthday, even though they may have graduated. What does that look like?
Well, typically we encourage the individuals to stay in school till their 22nd because they may have finished their academic mm-hmm. needs at the age of 8, which they could graduate, but most school systems have transition programs or...
Right.
They all
and
do.
It used to just be 21, and they just...
Right, and what? Now...
It's 22
and,
now.
Yeah, in 2020, they changed it to the 22nd birthday.
Mm-hmm.
So they stay in school till the last day of their 21st birthday, and we plan our day funding for their 22nd birthday. So we always want everything in place before that, you know,
mm-hmm.
services being identified. Hopefully everybody has their Husky C. They have a case manager. And I have to say that, you know, I've been in this position for 14 years, and it's amazing how far the school systems have come and how many programs. I mean, when I first started, most transition programs were in the high school. It's very, very few that are still in the high school and not in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And the relationships that have been built with the teachers and the transition advisors, I think all of the transition advisors statewide would say they have great relationships, and the word's getting out earlier and earlier, and more schools are doing parent nights, or we do professional development days, and the word is getting out. So we're knowing about students earlier.
That's good to hear, because over the years, I would get calls from parents and their children are 16, 17, just about to turn 18, and they didn't even know any of this.
Right.
So it's good to hear that then that's my other thing is, how are you marketing to families so that they know what's available to them? Because there's some families out there who are panicking, thinking, after 22, what do I do?
Right.
Because they don't even know.
Right.
So let me kind of roll back a little bit. We had a period of time as an agency where we didn't have our transition advisor staff. Or if we did, it was like one or two. And it was those years that we struggled probably the most.
Mm-hmm.
But we committed to getting these three positions each region to re-energize the relationships between our agency and school districts. Because it was often the school districts, the helpline, or school districts' case managers, and that there was not another party with kind of that educational focus. So since the three transition advisors in each region came on, our relationships with area school districts have exploded
mm-hmm.
into amazing collaborations and information sharing sessions. So as we talk about professional development day, I actually just did one 2 weeks ago in Bethel. The room was packed with psychologists and social workers and special education teachers. So they're really maximizing the opportunities to have us come in and talk about eligibility all the way through those resources I shared earlier and how do families access, etc. And then we rely on them to be those messengers to push that down to the students and to the families. We do resource fairs. We do virtual presentations.
Mm-hmm.
Parent groups will have us come in and do them. Whenever we possibly can, we are doing them. There is a transition symposium that's being sponsored by multiple agencies, State Department of Ed, CERC, DDS is a part of it, and DMOS is part of it, DRS is part of it, so there's a whole bunch of
okay.
CPAC.
Okay, I'm
going to
stop you right there and say, what are those acronyms?
Good job. It's testing you.
Yeah.
So, Department of Developmental
yeah.
Services, Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, Department of Labor, the State Department of Education, the Bureau of Rehabilitative Services. So those are just a host of the sponsoring entities. CPAC, Connected
mm-hmm.
Parent Advocacy Center also
mm-hmm.
involved. Disability Rights of Connecticut, or DRCT as we abbreviate
mm-hmm.
it, is also involved.
And we're
going to
put all this in the show notes too.
So That's another platform where we have a student track, a family track, and a professional track for informational sessions. And often we'll have, at least on one of those tracks, is a state agency panel. So where you would get a blast of like 10 minutes from each state agency and then have a Q&A at the end of it. And those are always recorded too, so participants can go back and reflect so that they're not, because it is a lot of overwhelming information, mm-hmm. and, you know, note-taking, don't worry, everything's recorded, you can go back and redo them. So we welcome all the opportunities, parent groups, professional groups, whatever it might be, to come out and do this information sharing. Our transition advisor group, we hold monthly meetings, and some of the target areas has been developing materials or revising materials for our stakeholder groups. So I'm kind of working off script here because this is the PowerPoint we typically would use, because most of the questions that we're having mm-hmm. today are in that subject area.
Right.
So I brought a copy along just for my own personal reference. But we do make that available. We developed it and embedded a whole bunch of hyperlinks into here so families can just click away when they get the PDF version and go right to those websites to get the information resources we've talked about from other state agencies or everywhere. We've done a bunch of other literature and handouts. So some of this is on our website. Some of it's tagged on the State Department of Ed's website in their transition section. So you just click and it jumps to our website and those forms and resources are right there. So we're trying to do a lot of different collaboration. However, like everything in this world, nothing's perfect. As I said earlier, we miss the mark here and there mm-hmm. getting to everybody. So the goal is to try to get to everybody. The question is, how do we get to everybody? Because we have literature. We have it translated into Spanish. We do virtual presentations. We now do podcasts. Yes. We do in-person presentations. We're on a host of different other like symposiums and things mm-hmm. like that, trying to get the word out from simple information about eligibility to those resources to the real in-depth dialogue on transition. And what is an individual plan? How does that level need to impact my loved one in planning for them? Why is it so critical that I get the Husky C, the Medicaid? And that's where we'll have other breakout sessions. So this group, the Transition Advisors, have done a great job and took away this PowerPoint and developed one just on employment and day services because families were asking for more information for us to come back and have those additional right. conversations. So it is that voice that we make, we alter our side of it, and just, we just peeled out a whole different presentation just on employment and day services. So what you get in the general overview is this like two or three slides. Now we have another 20-slide presentation that's on employment and day services to really hone in on just that subject area. So we always look for platforms to get the word out. So if you have suggestions, mm-hmm. if you're listening, let us know. If you in the room have suggestions, happy to. Because that's one thing. Some families have come to our own agency administration and said, I didn't know about this. Why didn't I know about this? Why didn't I get this information 5 years ago or 4 years ago? So it's how do we get it out there into the media that people are accustomed to using?
Right.
So, and with understanding that not everybody has technology, so we have to start here at the basic level all the way up to those who are more mm-hmm. tech savvy and are all over different social media platforms. How do we hit every single one of those populations? So we're always open for options and suggestions. So
Barbara, as a transition person, is there a checklist, a transition checklist that parents can use to say, okay, I need to do this, I need to do this?
Yes, there is.
Okay.
And that's one of our documents that we mm-hmm. share with the families. And
what are some of the things on that checklist?
Well, a lot of the things when you turn 18, doing guardianship, doing applying for SSI, mm-hmm. applying for the Husky C, if you're interested in employment, to get involved with BRS, the Bureau of Rehabilitative yeah. Services, to get a state ID, mm-hmm. to have open a bank account, to register to vote, all things that we feel are important for every individual to have that we support.
So a quick question on legal guardianship. Shouldn't that process start before they turn 18?
At 17 and a half, okay. they could
start that process.
Yes.
Yep. Let me roll you back there. Conversation should happen 17 and a half. But guardianship is just one platform. decision-making. So we encourage families and individuals to really look at what's out there that's the most appropriate, from least restrictive to most restrictive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Some will view it as guardianship and conservatorships as being the most restrictive options. So there is powers of attorney, there's natural supports. There's a big movement that's got a lot of state agencies and advocacy groups on board, and that's supported decision-making. So, and that's growing legs in Connecticut, and we're hopeful that that will be another recognized model for.
And this is where the life course can come into play, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So we encourage the conversation to happen. Families know their loved ones the best and what kind of decision-making they are able to do and not do. Guardianship is just one avenue, but the conversation should happen like 17, because as you said, 17 and a half is the mark where you could apply for guardianship six months prior to the 18th birthday to get that process started. Other avenues, you don't have to do that early, or you can choose to do guardianship when they're 30 if you wanted to. You don't have to do it right out the gate.
Right.
But that's the earliest part.
It's all individualized.
The critical piece is understanding that when a person in the state of Connecticut turns 18, that's the age of majority. They are their own person at that time and decision maker at that time.
Right.
So if there is a concern, if there is a question over the one's ability to make informed decisions in all life categories, the conversation needs to happen before that 18th birthday.
Right.
And talking to probate court or talking to our friends over at Disability Rights of Connecticut about other options, because they do a whole presentation on the various options as well. So there are resources out there. And we do, through our presentations, promote investigating all the different options. We don't sell just one or the other. It's really individualized. And we have many folks that we support in DDS who don't have guardians. They are their own guardians, their own decision makers. So all the way up to those who have full guardians that make informed decisions on with them on their behalf, depending on their abilities, in all life categories. So it runs the whole spectrum. So.
Regarding touring programs, if families are interested in looking that for their loved ones, when can they start doing that?
Well, they can visit at any time, but typically I say within the year, because...
Within the year before
they're exiting school, you know, any time. Sometimes going too early is the program's not going to look the same as it did when you went to visit it, especially in the way things have been post-COVID, or in COVID, I should say. Agencies have had a lot of staffing issues. A lot of agencies where they used to take one-to-ones will not do that anymore. So it's really important that families know what their options are, what agencies, which agencies will transport, because, you know, they may be able to go to the agency, but the agency isn't providing transportation. So it's important for them to get as much information as early as possible, but there is something as being too early where things have changed. So it's, you kind of have to work on an individualized basis. But I just want to say that we DDS transition advisors work off of a 5-year planning list. So we know about students 5 years ahead. And because of the relationships that we've built with the schools and, you know, the teachers and transition advisors, we're very, very often invited early to go to these PPTs, you know.
So you do go to PPTs?
Yes.
Okay, that's good to know.
It's probably one of the most important things that I think we do, because so much gets missed in the transition process if DDS isn't there, you know. So we do, and I will say mostly right now they've all been virtual, and I say, how did I ever have time to travel to PPT? And I've already done 3 PPTs today. So there's be no way to go back and forth, you know? So we're there. Now, sometimes individual won't have DDS services, and we get invited to the PPTs. We cannot go if the individual's not known to the department, but what I tell the teachers are is I'm happy to have a conversation with the families, not in a formal
So that meeting. Kind of circles back to the very first question of at 8 years old, this is when you should do it, because it'll make the transition that much smoother.
Barb,
We've been having quite a few discussions about what services look like for individuals who are under the age of 22 and they're still under the umbrella of the school system. Can you just give our listeners an idea of what services look like once they graduate and they enter a program outside of the school system?
Well, some individuals choose to enter a qualified provider. Some families do self-determination, so everybody's path can be different. Some, you know, individuals go right to work, so everybody's path is different. So it's very important for the transition advisors and the schools to work together with the families and individuals in the last year, because they may not have a DDS case worker, case manager yet. So we know that some programs are saying to our families, we want a level of need and an IP before we'll even consider an individual. So we're trying to say the school has a lot of information that, you know, yes, it's not a legal document with the level of
but
need.
It's helpful
know,
for but the process.
But they need it. So this, I really think it's important for the schools and the agencies to be in contact mm-hmm. if the family is interested. And I know, Jen, you've gone out to schools to see individuals and people from your program, and that's always the best start, is to have the agency go visit in their natural environment, and then if things are going to move forward, have the individual come to the program for a few visits before they exit school so they have familiar support mm-hmm. with them. And, you know, typically that's how the transitions work out best.
I just want to add to that. We do a lot of collaboration with the Bureau of Rehabilitation Services. Families and individuals will get letters in that final school year from us, really encouraging the dialogue with BRS to talk about employment. We are an employment first agency.
What does that mean, Brian?
Employment is a critical focus for the individuals we support. So we will be promoting that. Our case management or transition advisors is alike. We really push the consideration for each and every individual who is eligible for DDS to consider and pursue employment in Connecticut and not necessarily go to a traditional day program. We understand that it's not a one-size-fits-all, and some people are really ready and out the gate and maybe even have jobs before they exit at 22, and others might need a transition period from school into an employment model program, and we have services that offer that, and others very well may not make that employment, competitive employment goal in their life, but they might have programmatic goals that they work towards to try to get to some type of employment. Employment is a wonderful thing. You're working in the community, you're having interactions with community members in a setting that's not 100% disabled individuals. So you're in that inclusion mentality, mm-hmm. but you're also getting a paycheck.
Right.
And paychecks for I would say myself, it's very rewarding. I enjoy it.
Yeah.
And for many people, getting that paycheck is extremely rewarding,
mm-hmm.
and doing the work. And we found that individuals that are associated with our agency do phenomenal work in the community and all the work programs that they are in, whether it be a big box store or a big pharmacy to a mom and pop business. There's a lot of great opportunities in our communities for employment. It's just a matter of making that match and tapping into those interests and skill sets. So we do a lot of work with our friends at BRS on that. So we have a lot of messaging. We're actually looking at different ways to message earlier. So BRS has their Level Up program, and so they're embedded in school districts. So that's 16 to 22. And we're actually looking to send out a mailing that goes out with one of our general letters that we send out that will have additional information about BRS's services around employment as well. So we're trying to get the message out, because transition, I think Barbara said earlier, starts at elementary school.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You have to be thinking that early for that 22. It's a scary thought. But if you go back to the individual plan,
mm-hmm.
one of the tools that's in our IP is our trajectory. So your life course trajectory. So you can even break that out, elementary years, middle school years, high school years,
mm-hmm.
and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do one big one and then just, you know, break it out into subsections based on that, their educational life. But transition is a part all the way going down to 5 years old, 6 years old, 7 years old.
I mean, the individuals are transitioning from birth to three into a pre-K school program,
mm-hmm.
then from pre-K to kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
And then whenever elementary ends in that town, to middle school, then middle school to high school. So transitions are happening. And
right.
so this, the earlier, like you said, the better.
And
right.
those goals in the IEP are the academic focus and
mm-hmm.
such, but there's also ways to look at it differently to try to get it focused in on that post-22, that post-secondary.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And being as strong and independent of an individual they could possibly be, safe in their community, money skills, employment skills, etc. So there's a host of different things that can be started in a slow incremental increases along that educational pathway.
Yeah, my own experience, the schools may not always, didn't always agree with me, but I think I started with my son when he was probably in fourth or fifth grade. Our elementary went to fifth grade, where the last 5 minutes I brought him into my PPT meeting. And they were like, why? I go, because he's in fourth and fifth grade now. He has a voice. He can talk a little bit. So that started him advocating for himself. And the people that were writing the reports got to know him a little bit more.
And that's critical, because when you're in a room amongst professionals, you're looking at a name on paper.
Exactly.
But you're not looking at the face of the student or the face of the individual, in our cases,
mm-hmm.
to whom you're speaking of. Having them at the table, even if it's a moment to say hello, thank you for being
Absolutely.
Here and supporting
mm-hmm.
me, and going back to school, that's fine. But being a part of it and having that connection between that's the face, that's the student, that's what I'm looking, you know, and
Absolutely.
Developing that is critical.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we brought that right back to the forefront of our individual plan documents, is that personal profile.
Yeah.
And it talks so much
mm-hmm.
about the individual, and are able to express how to best support them. This is me. How are you going to support me in the best ways, and how I don't want to be supported? It really sets the tone for the discussion for the rest of the planning meeting. So it's critical. It's definitely critical. But that whole employment conversation starts earlier.
Yes.
You know? Personal
right.
story. I volunteered
yeah.
with my mother back in the day doing Special Olympics when I was in elementary school.
Right.
And here I am
mm-hmm.
working with that population. Well, I'm not going to count the years.
Right.
Many years after those
right.
initial exposures, volunteering
mm-hmm.
at Special Olympics. So you just, that mindset, you start planting the seed of and work through volunteer experiences.
Yeah.
So there are a host of different ways people can do it. But we really do push employment. But we do respect people's decisions. And then we shift gears in the planning mode and look at other services. Barbara mentioned private providers. We do have a listing on our website of qualified providers,
mm-hmm.
Which families can access independent of reaching out to
mm-hmm,
us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's updated regularly. So it's a pretty big document, but that's for our staff to transition.
But that's
providers.
A good thing.
Right. Right. It is a great thing.
Choice.
Exactly. But use us to help sort that out.
Mm-hmm.
We can't direct you to a particular agency because that would be unethical.
Right.
However, we can say these six are within a good distance from your family home
right.
to consider and
the
engage.
Logistics. Mm-hmm.
And you talk about how early is too early. Well, yes, programs can change, but we have families who are engaged with local providers well before transition age. They're part of boards. They do recreation programs in the afternoons and things like that. So some families make those connections very early and kind of formulate their decision, my loved one's going to go and get services through them when they leave school. Or they find that, you know what, that's not the agency for, and they still do their volunteer or whatever, or
mm-hmm.
board, but my child's going this direction because they may not have a service, or you know what, it's not a match, you know?
Right, not a match, right.
And we do have opportunities. We have other providers, and we do have an opportunity to self-direct for those who,
mm-hmm.
who just don't want to engage with provider network and they want to self-direct their supports. We have that as an option as well. So,
wow, yeah. So much great information for
yes.
our listeners, and I think Tisha and I actually
mm-hmm.
learned quite a bit today.
Absolutely. I can't thank you guys enough taking the time out of your busy schedules to come here and do this with us, but I think it's going to be so beneficial to families. And, you know, I just want to mention to the listeners, there was a lot of stuff thrown out there, acronyms and places, and we're going to put all this on the show notes so that people can have easy ways to access the website and different options and different resources.
And I'll make sure you have my contact information too, so you can put that in the show notes
absolutely.
As well. So if there is a particular need or whatever, families can email me. It's the easiest way. I'll respond at a variety of different hours of the day. or I'll just send it over to an appropriate staff in my division to address and get back to the family. So
excellent.
Again, thank you so much. And thank you for the work you guys do.
Thank you for having us. This is great.
As always, you can find our podcast on Podbean, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and the Sarah Inc. website. On any Amazon or Alexa-enabled devices, you can ask Alexa to play 99% Effective Sarah Solutions podcast. And let us know, what do you want to learn more about? If you have an idea or topic, let us know. We would love to hear from you.